The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Thursday, August 10th, and it's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri, and I shall be your host for the day as I do a little thing differently. Now, mind you, today is supposed to be open line Thursday. I don't want open line because the news is the same news as yesterday, basically. And I will save an open line for another day where I analyze the news. So, few minutes ago, I was doing bullying. Yeah, at times I bully people. And guess who I was bullying? I bully Erin Green because she was interviewing people. And I said, Erin, since I know you, you've never been interviewed on the radio. I know people interview me, and I had to give all my history or whatever it is. But I want to know you. You are an advocate. You went off to school. You went abroad. But nobody knows this. Nothing is on record. So, you know, we had some wrangling before. We had some wrangling because she said no. And I said, yeah. And she said, no. And I said, yeah. And she said, no. And she said, yeah. And I said, you see, we can do it anyway because we own the time. And April is on the line, and she beckoning me, and I need to start the show. So the show can start. The show is going to start, and we're going to be concentrating on airing things that most people know but did not know, right? And I wanted to add into this advocacy because she's an advocate, right? And because she's the first person who explained to me the difference between an advocate and an activist, right? But I want to get into that story on how Erin Green become Erin Green, you know? She's one of the smartest persons I know. I mean, you need to see the education this woman has. And to know that she's independent and made herself independent of everything else, right? To try to live off the grid. And I want to know how she come to conclude that that's the way that she plans to live. Because, you know, she come from a life of privilege. That's a good word.
And sensible people.
And disciplined people who expect much. I mean, demanding people who expect much of her. So without further ado, I just want to welcome Erin Green and thank you very much for agreeing to do this interview because I know it's kind of challenging for you to make yourself vulnerable to say you are the other end of the mic.
Yeah, you see that, eh?
Yes.
And I just have these young people in my studio talking about vulnerability, right? And the need to be vulnerable in order to grow.
Yes.
Right?
And we'll start from there. Who is Erin Green? When I say who is Erin Green, parents, your lineage, and the school you went to.
All right. So I'm Erin Green, my mother, Leela Mitchell Green from the Fort Hill, my father, Bernard Leon Green, deceased a number of years now, grandmother, Corinne Mitchell, and grandmother, Una Hasty Prosper.
And
I come from the Mitchell Boyd Gay clan and a Hasty Tynes clan on the paternal side. I went to QC, mm-hmm. Queens College. Started off at Mrs. Hall Preschool.
Yes.
On Johnson Road. It's a couple of people I remember, but I sent a shout out from preschool days, huh?
Yes.
But I grew up in the Anglican and the Methodist churches. Anglican, go to Anglican church every Sunday. Spent summers in the Methodist summer program from the age of 5 to 18. Became a counselor in training at 13. And then sort of left that system at 18. I remember at 16, my priest from Anglican church, Father walking in, he said, look here. I hear you be summer counseling with the Methodists. He was Anglican too, and we have programs too. And he said, look, you better come. And so Vacation Bible School with the Anglican Church for a couple of years, even with the government summer program, right? A counselor for that program. So a life full of volunteerism, right?
Yes, and I assume that's how you lead into your activism type activity.
Yeah.
Before you went there, right, you belonged to a clan, Hannah Hastie clan.
Yeah.
Through your
father.
Through your father lineage. And you belong to a Fort Hill clan.
Yeah.
Because when you say Fort Hill, that's a culture by itself.
Yeah.
Right? And I want you to tell me how you grew up on the Fort Hill, that type of content.
Okay.
Because you never come outside.
That's right.
I was down the road, you never come outside.
Yeah, Corinne Mitchell wouldn't let us off the side porch, right? I mean, literally off the side porch. And so there's, I grew up
the Fort Hill.
No, of New Providence.
No, I'm going to get to the life of privilege soon, but I'm just talking about Fort Hill. Go ahead.
Yeah, so my grandmother, Corinne Mitchell House, right opposite the police station headquarters, right? My aunt up through the road there, right there, by Pop Simonet, Junkyard Shop, right? My grandmother had property all through there. But I never was able to go out and have fun and explore the inner city like my other cousins because my grandmother had a different rule for us and my mother's children, which was, y'all can't come off the side porch, right? Our access to what was happening was very limited in that space.
So you were very protected growing up?
In that space. I
mentioned that you have from a life of privilege.
Yeah.
Your parents had some change. Not really real money, but change. Some good money.
Well, I think that they were civil servants in the initiation of the government. They were civil servants, and they were educated. And my father didn't have a degree. I don't think. My mother had a degree. And my mother went continuing education. My father as well, right? Even in his professional life as a customs officer, he invested in continuing education. Education was a major proponent, right, of my life growing up and the culture. I was raised in a culture of appreciation for education. I was raised in a culture of appreciation for common sense, having sense, and being sensible, right, and thinking, and it was important to know the right answer. And I say that like that because I realize now, 40 years later, it is not important to many people to know the right answer. Like, it's not important to know that you have the right answer. And I'm struck by it, right? It's been a massive, I think, devolution in the culture of appreciation for education in this country. You know, you alluded to something. I don't have a degree.
I'm going to get to that.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, your parents expected things of you.
Yeah.
Persons who went to Queens College expected things of you.
Yeah.
After you graduate from Queens College, one of the top students, right?
Yeah.
They expected things of you. You went off.
Yeah.
And can you say where you went off? And then what happened? You changed directions. You changed course for yourself, for fulfillment. And I want to know what happened there.
So I went to, I think it started with UE, came back, I did COB, then went off to boarding school.
So you went off to boarding school. Where did you go to boarding school?
I went to a boarding school that a number of Bahamian young women have gone to and go to, have gone to, St. Elphin's all-girls school.
Yeah, my wife went to St. Elphin's.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Go ahead.
And so I don't have a bachelor's. I've got a number of A-levels. And so, like, when you talk about, like, the expectations from my family, I think there is a bit of a disappointment, right? Like I said, my uncle told me when I got an A for achievement and a C for effort that he was not pleased. Mm-hmm. Because if I had put in more effort, then maybe I could have gotten even more than an A, mm-hmm. right? And it was like, but the A is the top of the line. And he's like, nah. It's not, you know, it's not the top of the line. And so I could feel that, right? There's a sense of, but if she had a degree, mm-hmm. you know, maybe she'd make more sense. Or maybe some people say maybe she'd actually make sense. Some people think I'm not making any sense. And some people are like, she's smart. So I think, you know, in that culture, culture of appreciation for education, there is a tension, right? Yeah, she's smart, but she don't have a degree.
Still. So right. Has that been like a stumbling block because of your term in terms of making money, in terms of having a quality of life in terms of...
Yeah. Oh, you, without a doubt, because you go look at an application, the criteria is you got to have a bachelor's degree. And I come to an interview and I can speak and I can show that I'm intelligent, that I have sense, you know, that I have the requisite skills despite the degree. But it is a stumbling block. And particularly after I became an advocate, right, a LGBTI rights and a human rights advocate, that was a stumbling block. And then not having a bachelor's degree made it easier, right, to block, to blockade.
To block.
Yeah.
Block you. So let's finish this education. You went to UWE. You went to COB. You went to UWE.
Yeah.
You went to St. Elphins.
Yeah.
And
I came back to COB.
And you came back to COB, okay.
I did the COB-UWE law program.
So you went to law school.
Yeah, I went to law school. I don't have a law degree. I am not a lawyer. I don't have a law degree. I haven't been to the bar. None of those. I don't qualify for none of those things. Mm-hmm. But I've been to law school.
You've been to law school.
And I can tell you, I've been to law school twice. I tried it. I really tried hard. I went twice.
Two
I tried
separate
hard.
Individual times. You said, man, I can do this.
Yeah,
and that.
I could be honest with you. UB taught me a lot of things. COB and UB taught me a lot of things. And one thing it taught me, perhaps the most important thing, is to not settle. To not settle. Right? Like when you know something is not just, don't settle. I think my experience at COB and UB, I tell people, I said it on the show, I said it on Guardian Platform, I've dropped out four times, and if you all have me back, I come in, mm-hmm. and I'm prepared to drop out again if I have to, right? And I'm not going to settle. And people say, but what hubris, who you think you is? You gone to the school for them to teach you, mm-hmm. And you're saying that you're not going to settle for what it is they're providing. But I think that's something that we need to teach our young people. Part of that is my privilege, right? There are people mm-hmm. who say, look here, I'm not settling. I'm getting this degree so that I could go on and do what I know is intended for me, right? I'm just doing this. I'm just getting it done so that I can move on to what it is I really want to do. And I'm not discounting that at all. I'm not discounting that spirit in Bahamians that have gone through the UBCOB system. And if I had children, maybe my experience would be different, right? But I've been privileged enough to be able to stand on some principles.
But before we delve briefly on your personal life, and I said vaguely, right? Compare and contrast, you living in the United Kingdom and the Bahamas, right? We have some hiccups here in the Bahamas. And the United Kingdom was to be first world and develop, right? Mm-hmm. What is the starking contrast between the two realities?
Systems work. In England, you could get up every day and trust that systems will be working. And when they weren't working, you know that the system is still working because there's an indicator the systems, right? And I think that's one of the biggest differences in being in Britain. I was in London, I was in Derby, being in the UK and versus being in the Bahamas. I was in the UK, I experienced two power outages the entire time over a space of approximately from 1996 to 1999, for like 4 years. Mm-hmm. I experienced two power outages. One in Derby in a snowstorm in winter, and then one in London. And there was no guessing when the power would come back on. Notices, you know what I'm saying? The systems were in place and systems worked, and you could go about your individual life not worried about having to be a part of a clique or an association to have access to information to make things work. Things work the way they're supposed to work, and you could trust that.
So you're saying that the United Kingdom had checks and balances, and the Bahamas tend not to...
check for the balances, essentially. But also...
Because you complain about traffic all the time. You complain about power outage all the time.
Right, but acknowledging that we're a young country, right? And we still have... we're such a young country compared to Great Britain in such a young nation, different from country, mm-hmm. such a young nation compared to Great Britain, that we don't even realize that we don't have systems yet. We just thought that the systems would automatically arise and that they would run themselves. And they have been running themselves for the last 50 years, essentially. But they're now on the pendulum is swinging, right? And in running themselves, they're devolving. But there's a big thing. We still meant systems, right? When I was in Great Britain, I never actually operated a motor vehicle.
You didn't learn to drive?
No, I didn't. I knew how to drive. I didn't drive. I didn't have access to a vehicle. I wasn't insured. Driving a vehicle was never part of the game. I was in a private vehicle, not a taxi, but a private vehicle over those 4 years, no more than six times. Subway, train, bus, pedestrian movement, right? That's it. The transportation systems worked reasonably, I mean, very, very well compared to what we have here.
We don't have
a system here. And you could rely on that. So as a student, I'd get my bus pass, my transportation pass, which would be bus, train, or subway for the month. And all I had to do was touch my card to the machine or slip it in a slot. And I was good for the entire month. Bus, train, subway.
And hopefully we get there one of these days. But let's get back to you.
Yeah.
And your narrative, right? And I'm going to allow you to lead this part of the conversation because it's going to be a more intimate type of conversation, right? You're about 16, 18-ish, right?
Mm-hmm.
Moving into your sexuality, trying to find yourself. Mm-hmm. And one of these days you found, hey, I different.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know that transition or that acknowledgement that I'm different and then how you maneuvered, worked your way to find your space and say, okay, I am comfortable with myself.
I was quote unquote straight for most of my life.
I understand that. You're not going back. You just quote unquote what?
I was just straight. I never explored it. I never thought about lesbianism or a relationship with a woman until I was well into 18, 19, not even 19, 20, well after I came back from boarding school. Like, well after. It wasn't a boarding school experience that caused that. When I was in boarding school, I had a boyfriend. My boyfriend wrote me a lovely letter. I mean, it's the most beautiful man ever, right? I left as an 18-year-old, I leave for boarding school to do A-levels, right? And after about 4 months of being there, he wrote this beautiful letter to say, hey, the distance is too much. I have needs. I don't want to cheat on you. And so I'm writing to let you know that I have to break up with you. Right? And I love you, but I's a man. And I have needs. It's a beautiful letter. I love all men because of that letter. Right? Like this idea that because you're a lesbian, you don't love men. That letter, it was just a moment. I saw what man was. And I keep that, right, as a standard for other men. Left boarding school. I think I went to UE for half a year, came back, and made a friend, a male friend. We started hanging out together. And I realized moving through town and meeting people and meeting women and meeting men as well, right? I realized that I enjoyed my engagement with women far more than I enjoyed my engagement with the men that I met at that time. Now, interviewing Aaron Green, I identify as a lesbian, a preference for women. I experience attraction to men.
Because I'm sexy, I know that. She used to be looking at me. No, go ahead, sorry.
I mean, you're allowed to love yourself too.
Okay.
And I appreciate that, right? You're allowed to love yourself.
Yes, okay.
And later in life, I realized that, and I was even open to it at the time, you know. At the time, I was open to the idea that I am just not attracted to the men that I am meeting. I am just not attracted to the men in my circle, right? And perhaps I need to meet more men. And I went on and met men in the Caribbean, met men in the UK, and just realized that I was appreciating my engagement with women and relationships with women far more than with men. I love men. I appreciate them. And in many instances, especially when I was younger, it wasn't that I wasn't attracted to men. I wasn't aroused by men or didn't want to be in relationship with men. But particularly when I became a public advocate,
mm-hmm.
I felt that it would be problematic and unreasonable and maybe even dysfunctional for me to attempt to have a relationship with a Bahamian man as a bisexual out LGBTI advocate in the Bahamas. And that what man will walk around and say, yeah, no, that's my thing. Yeah, she see other people, she see other women, but she see women, but that's my thing. And I realized that just isn't, it just didn't make any sense at the time. It seemed unsafe. And so really pursued anything with those men.
So, okay, you accepted yourself. Yeah. You accepted that you are a lesbian woman and that you're not going to pursue men.
No,
You're still looking?
Now I'm in a relationship.
You're
with
in a relationship.
Someone,
so yes. Yeah, you're settled now. Yeah, this is who you are. This is who you are now. I want to know, how did you become an advocate? Because at one point in time, you had your own advocacy group or activist group. You were active in the community on TV, doing tours, touring Caribbean, United States, whatever it is, get invited to promote, defend, mm-hmm. if I may use that word, a community. I want to know, how did you transition to that?
So soon after dating women and engaging with women, I realized that generally in the Bahamas, our interpersonal relationship dynamics are a bit wonky. Like, I felt like the way that men and women related to each other, the things they expected from each other in many instances were dysfunctional and problematic and even sort of contradicting and combative, right? So I look at the way that gay people, queer people, men and women, the way that they were interacting, like I trying to find out where the people socialize, and it's a secret, it's a this and a that. And I said to myself, it's a very clear question, like, you know, this is not a safe space to be gay in.
I want to explore that. What do you mean? You're trying to say that the Bahamas is not a safe space for queer and LGBTQ community to live openly? It's migrant to a party.
I want to say yes, but I want to tell you why. It's not that the Bahamas is completely and totally intolerant to gay people or any visible expression of their sexuality or their relationships. That's not it. It's that generally we have devolved into poor interpersonal and intimate partner relationships. Our social and familial boundaries and rules have devolved. And within that context now, you have people who have same-sex attraction trying to live and experience themselves in like clandestine ways, right? So for instance, I used to bartend at a spot one night a week at an event. I used to bartend. I used to tell jokes and then bartend the rest of the time. And a number of women and younger women would be flirting with me and coming on to me in a space with their male partner right there.
Oh, look at that.
Right? And I realized that those younger people were not taking into account, right? Like, they weren't being, I don't want to use the word integritas, right? Like, they weren't acting with integrity. But they weren't thinking critically. They weren't thinking rationally. They weren't thinking about their partner. They weren't thinking about their partner. And so I realized quickly that we need to advocate for safe spaces, and we need to do work within the wider community.
I see we have a caller here, but you said about safe spaces, and I want you to expand on that only because recently, even though this interview is about you, even because recently, there is a promotion to have a safe space for the community to be downtown. And it was advertised for the community. And of course, social media got ablaze.
Yeah.
People demanded that it can't happen here.
Yeah.
There'll be no safe space for that community here.
Yeah.
We don't want you to be safe in that community. I want to know, as a person in that community, how does that make you feel? One, what does that say to other people in the lifestyle too? And is there a definite need to carve out safe spaces for the community?
Before we go to the call, I don't like the term "in the lifestyle."
And forgive me for
that. But that's cool. We can explore that a little later. But I'm just saying that. You got to introduce the call and not me.
No, I was going to let you speak, explain that and come to the call
afterwards. Okay, cool. Lifestyle is separate from orientation, right? Lifestyle is like, after work, I unwind by going to happy hour. I drink a couple beers. I come home. It's Friday night football. It's Monday night football. It's Wednesday night Bible study. That's like lifestyle, right? We're talking about orientation, right? And sexual orientation is who you are naturally attracted to, right? Behavior and lifestyle are separate from orientation. I could be attracted to men and in a non-monogamous relationship, multiple people, right?
But
I could do that.
With the safe space, the need, if there's a need for the safe space.
Okay, but I just wanted to get into sort of lifestyle thing. Okay, cool. Of course there's need for safe spaces, right? I just had a group of young Christians on talking about the space that they have created for young people to explore Christianity and themselves in a safe space. Everybody needs safe spaces. Young people need safe spaces in their homes, right? They need a safe space where it's only things that are appropriate for kids to see around them. They need a space where, like, if they watch TV, they shouldn't be watching TV with you at 10 p.m. They shouldn't be watching what the adults watch. They need a safe space. In the same way, LGBT people, given the violence that they experience, sometimes at home, sometimes in the workplace, sometimes in the general community, sometimes in relationship, they need a safe space to be able to just be without fear that somebody is going to attack them, whether it's psychological violence, spiritual violence, or physical violence.
I'm going to be brief because I want to continue our interview with you, because I want to know, you mentioned safe space. Have you ever feel unsafe, threatened, living as a lesbian woman in Bahamas? And I want to know also, you're not active in terms of advocacy. And I want to know what happened for that too. But let's go to the caller for that. Go ahead, caller. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. Aaron, I really appreciate you for just being, you know, if most people were comfortable with themselves the way you are with yourself, the world would be a better place. But I feel for what you're trying to do in this safe space. Tell me, how do you manage how would you manage your life if now that you with a female, and if she up one morning or evening and say, look, I don't want you anymore, how much would that break you up? Or because I know persons of this type of persuasion, they seem to have a hidden level of anxiety, which can become very violent. I've witnessed it. Okay. So I wonder how would that affect you? And then bring me up to speed with the LGBTQI. Explain that whole gambit of
letters.
Letters to me, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. So let's start with LGBTQI. When the acronym started, it was LGBT. The acronym was created for the purpose of advocacy and political discourse, right? Most people don't use LGBT or Q to define themselves, right? Q can mean queer, which is a North American in the region and in the global South is still sort of uncomfortable with the word queer. It can mean questioning as well, which is like curious. But most people don't use that language at all in their everyday life. L is lesbian, B is bisexual, which means you're attracted to both men and women. G is gay, T is transgender. I is intersex, which we commonly know as hermaphrodite. But hermaphrodite is considered a derogatory term or slur now. But for people who are sort of Christian, they would know the term hermaphrodite, and that means intersex. There's a P for pansexual, right? And what pansexual means is not only am I attracted to men and women, but it could be a person who says I'm a woman in a man's body. It could be a person who said I'm a man in a woman's body, right? I just love people. I'm attracted to people, and there's no real rules. Now, the classifications go on and on and on because people feel a need to identify themselves, right? People feel a need to say, this is who I am. And for the purpose of organizing in advocacy and political spaces, that language comes up. But most people, I am Erin, and this is my partner, and my partner is also a woman. That's it. That's the extent of the identity.
I appreciate that. It's right now, it's time for going to break. I know we'll come back on the other side to answer the rest of the questions. But then I want to pick up on how come you're not an active activist anymore? What happened? And then I want to pick up on whether you felt yourself threatened or in danger for being who you are. All right. But anyway, this guy in Radio on the AM with C.A. Nuri, of course, I'm activist Erin Green. And we'll be right back.
Are you ready to win your ship 8,000 in cash when you capture the spirit of the Bahamas with your camera? Scotiabank, in partnership with the Guardian Media Group, invites all youth, amateur, and professional photographers to enter the Celebrate Bahamas 50 Photography Competition. Visit guardiantalkradio.com or bs.scotiabank.com to find out how to enter. Snap those photos and send them in by Friday, August 31st. Let's celebrate our proud nation in photos and win your share 8,000 in cash. Terms and conditions apply.
Vaccines protect those we love the most, our children and our grandchildren. I vaccinated my children to protect them. Getting your child immunized can protect them against diseases like polio, measles, whooping cough, and others. So protect your child today by getting them immunized. My grandchildren are vaccinated. You should do the same. Vaccinate your children and your grandchildren and make sure they are safe.
Vaccines are essential for new and returning students. As you begin back-to-school preparations, ensure that your children's vaccinations are up to date. All vaccines are available at all public health clinics.
Brought to you by PAHO WHO, the Ministry of Health and Wellness, and USAID.
Okay, school bag, books, pencils, uniform, oh Lord, and I gotta buy snacks too? Just lay it
on the line. The Guardian Media Group and AML Foods want to help families in need with our first ever Back to School Snackathon. What's a snackathon? Well, we want to help by assisting in donating school snacks to children that may need them as they head back to school this year. To be a part of our snackathon, all you have to do is shop at your favorite Salomon Superstore or Fresh Market. At the store, you can donate your pre-existing loyalty points, or you can donate cash directly at the register. Every single penny will go towards purchasing snacks that will be donated for distribution by the Bahamas Feeding Network and Hands for Hunger. Together, we can ensure that every child that opens their backpack this year will have a snack and a smile.
Get involved, get involved.
Grab your camera, capture the spirit of the Bahamas, and win cash and prizes. Scotiabank, in partnership with the Guardian Media Group, invites all youth, amateur, the Celebrate Bahamas 50 photography competition, being held under the theme One Nation, One Legacy, Our Future. With more than $8,000 in cash to be won, snap those photos and send them in by August 30th. Visit guardiantalkradio.com or bs.scotiabank.com to find out how to enter. Let's celebrate our proud nation in photos. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
And welcome back to Guardian Radio AM with C.A. Nuri. Of course, today I'm interviewing Aaron Green, advocate, human rights advocate. Once upon a time, before I knew you personally, mm-hmm. right, I said, oh, that's Aaron Green, the gay advocate. But you were not a gay activist. You were a human rights activist because you did human rights work, mm-hmm. right? Once upon a time, like I said earlier, you were on the TV. You were traveling. You were on the circuit. Something mm-hmm. happened. You don't do that no more.
Okay, so yeah. Well, I'm still an advocate. I'm always an advocate. I haven't been in the front line of advocacy, it appears, for a long time. My advocacy has evolved. When I started my advocacy work, I joined an organization called CAFRA, Caribbean Association for Feminist Research and Action. It's a regional umbrella organization with a body in the Bahamas. And I worked with that organization for a number of years, joined in like 1999, 2000, and then became the local rep for the umbrella organization. And while working in that space, I joined a group that was organizing Pride events. Pride, we organized a Pride event in 2000, I think in one. We organized a Pride event in 2002. And in 2003, while we were organizing the third annual Pride weekend, the Independence church service was going on. And Bishop Sam Green got up and said, if Parliament enact same-sex marriage, I will be the next Guy Fawkes. Now, that was such a bold and frightening statement at the time. It turns out that Bishop Samuel Green was a member of the Constitutional Reform Committee that had been formed by the newly elected PLP government after they made a commitment to continue to follow up on the constitutional reform exercise of the previous administration, right? But they said they would expand it. They would open it up to the Bahamian public. They would create a booklet to offer options for reform, right? To engage a nationwide exercise of constitutional reform. It turns out that one of the things they discussed in their work as a committee were LGBT rights and rights around marriage. Now, when I say LGBT rights, here's what we mean. What we mean is that LGBT rights are human rights, and LGBT people are prevented from experiencing or enjoying the same rights as other people, or when their rights have been breached, the state refuses to recognize that these are rights that everyone should enjoy. Bang. So when Bishop Green made that statement, members of the Pride Organizing Committee became and formed the Rainbow Alliance of the Bahamas, the first public advocacy and support group for LGBT people in the Bahamas, right? And so we didn't have a hierarchical power structure. I was a public spokesperson for the group along with two other spokespeople. And then I was a public spokesperson for RAB until it was disbanded in 2008. When I was the only member left in the organization, right? In that time, I'd also joined a regional LGBT advocacy group called Carry Flags, and I was a rep for the Bahamas for women's rights within that space. And then in 2013, I joined SASH Bahamas, Society Against STIs and HIV and AIDS. And then I left them in 2015 and continued my work as an individual advocate without a formal organization up until the present. In 2015, national reform exercise was announced by the then newly elected PLP government. And I, after speaking to a number of women's rights advocates and LGBTI rights advocates, launched a campaign to ensure that no LGBTI negative provisions were entrenched in the Bahamas Constitution. I ran that campaign by myself for 3 years, 2013 to 2016, and then post that all the way up to 2019. In the midst of that, in that time, I ran that constitutional reform campaign by myself. It was successful. The position I put forth was initially trounced upon. I was accused of hijacking the entire national affair by women's rights advocate and government actors. At the end of the day, it turns out that my position was correct. I went to the UN at the 71st CEDAW session where the Bahamas government was presenting. And the CEDAW committee asked the minister, Campbell, at the time, are there protections for LGBTI people in Bahamian law? He referred to the representatives from the AG's office who indicated that, yes, there are provisions for LGBTI Bahamians for protections wherever there are protections against sex-based discrimination. So the campaign was successful in that sense, but it was detrimentally problematic in that time. I experienced a lot of death threats, a lot of marginalization. I've had individuals come to me and confess that, yes, they conspired against me. They attempted to malign my character in an attempt to, you know, stop my thwart or disrupt my message and the campaign. In the midst of that, I had a particular experience where I was being stalked via telephone for over 3 years. It was never resolved. I wanted to do the right thing. Remember, we say my mother grew up on the Fort Hill, right? And so there's a degree of privilege there, not just economic, but social privilege. She would have grown up with Perry Christie. She knew all the people in power. And I didn't want to use her privilege to resolve my problem, especially since she didn't cause the problem. So I said, I'm going to go to my police station nearest my house. And over 3 years, I would create a call log documenting when the calls came in and what was said. Went to my police station, filed a report, go to check up on the report after several months and to be told that they don't know what I'm talking about. There's no file here. Start the process over again, create a call log, take it back to the station, come check back after a few months to find out that there is no file here. After the third time that happened, I say, you know what, I'm going to have to move a step further. I had been requesting an audience with the then Prime Minister Hubert Ingram, got nowhere for 6 months. He left office. Perry Christie assumed Prime Minister office. Called him, got a meeting almost instantaneously. He told me, go to the Commissioner of Police's office at headquarters. He'll be waiting for you. If not, he'll be there shortly. Had a meeting with him. He told me we're going to deal with this matter. Several months later, two police officers showed up to my house, asked to speak to myself and my mother because the telephone is in my mother's, well, technically, trying to get it into my mother's name. It was still in my father's name, even though he died about 30 years prior. Those two officers came to my house to tell me, and I quote, but Telco has determined that the threat is not sufficient to warrant further investigation. Bang. I imagine my mother in her frustration. You could imagine that you are a longstanding civil servant and something as small as this can't be resolved, as opposed to pushing the matter further, hoping that the individual would call back and we could create another call log and an attempt to determine who it is. She just changed the telephone number. So I stand here today in 2023 with no idea who was stalking me, no idea why the police would not investigate, and no idea why it appears as if Patelco refused to give the police access to what they needed to investigate. I've had other similarly troubling experiences while being here. I've been attacked. I've had to pepper spray someone. I've had police officers close doors in my face. Like, you know, if I didn't step back, I'd have a broken nose. At the same time, I must make this point, I've interacted with police officers that have been tremendously empathetic and as helpful as they could be, right? And so it's not, I'm not painting a picture of the entire police force at all. It's very helpful police officers. But a lot of that, and particularly the experience that I had during the referendum campaign from both people who say they're proponents of human rights, advocates, fellow advocates in the field, I took a step back from advocacy to the 2018 CEDAW session. Fortunately, I was invited to speak at the Commonwealth Law Association conference back to back, so 2019 and 2021, which I think took place in 2022. I was invited to speak and I was able to present my positions in various forms at both events. So I had taken a step back from advocacy. With the tabling and passing of the Protection Against Violence Bill, I am taking a few steps forward back into advocacy. But I've never, let me just finish it right here. Mm-hmm. My advocacy has evolved to the principle of everyone has a right to a life free of violence, and that's where my work sits right now. So it doesn't seem like it's frontline, but I'm always advocating.
I appreciate this interview, Erin. I know it took you a second to say, let me be vulnerable and ask the questions. Yeah. So we have to continue this because yeah. I enjoyed where this is going and I want to talk more about your advocacy work and what's new for Erin, what's next for Erin Green in general. So perhaps we'll do that on another week, another time. But this has been God in Radio on the AM with C.A. Nuri. Thanks very much for Erin yielding to me for a second. Yeah, and we see you tomorrow, right? Have a wonderful day.